Chatter on Books. It's Cliff Notes for book clubs. Why read the book if you can listen to Chatter on Books? I'm Jamie McIntyre, your announcer, but you don't care about that. Here again is your host, Tori Clark.
Welcome back to Chatter on Books. We have a really terrific show this evening, and I really kind of struggle on how to introduce our author in a little bit. So I'm going to do the reverse of the blurb on his book. So among other things, this author earned a Grierson Award nomination for Presenter of the Year because of a Discovery Channel series. He's had a couple bestsellers, including one that international bestseller translated into 20 languages. He was in prison where he studied law, science, history, also taught himself how to write, educated himself pretty seriously there. And before that, kind of his start in life. You know, we often ask our writers, what did you want to be when you were five? I can't wait to ask that question. He is a former mafia associate and heist expert. I don't know what a heist expert is, but we'll find out. It is Luis Ferrante. The book is Brigada, Rise of Empire. It's the first in a trilogy, A History of the American Mafia, and it is great. But first, Claude's off doing something. So Lauren Larson, thank you, is doing the important work. David is with us looking very sporty and about to look even sportier soon when he gets another haircut. And Rodney Ferguson, man about town, celebrity mixologist. Welcome back, guys.
Hello.
Can we talk about the Super Bowl?
Sure.
Stayed up for the whole thing.
Good for you.
It was a good game.
It was a good game.
Did you real sports people enjoy it?
Yeah, it was fine. It was fine. It was not, I mean, it wasn't like the most well-played game I've ever seen, but it was competitive and close, and that's what all you can ask for.
The stakes were fairly evenly dispensed among, you know, both sides and the coaches and Tony Romo and, you know, everyone
Tony's
else.
Going to stop talking. He just talks way too much.
It's dogs and dogs. It's so funny you see that because I watch very little NFL these days because I do have mixed feelings about it. But I wanted to watch that game, and I generally don't listen to CBS or watch CBS. So I did. And about halfway through the game, I turned to Brian and I said, does he talk too much? And he goes, yes. And he says, yeah, that's the rap on him for quite some time. But David, somebody should counsel him because sometimes in there, there are some insights that are really interesting and helpful and whatever to the amateur sports fan like me.
Absolutely. And he's really good. That's not the issue is not that he's not good at analyzing games. Well, my experience in doing games on TV is that sometimes less is more.
Yeah.
It's a visual medium. And we have this it's a very common practice in every sporting event. When there is a major moment in a game, in which the game is decided, whether it's a dramatic home run or a breakaway goal in hockey or soccer or the last second three pointer in basketball, when that play happens, there's a name for it. It's called laying out. You lay out. You shut up. Don't say anything. And let the pictures tell the story of what just happened. And when Mahomes threw the Super Bowl winning touchdown to Mecole Hardman, you're supposed to lay out. Stop talking.
Yeah. Even on smaller, less significant plays, Tony Romo would be talking about, well, one or two things going to happen here. And he talks very quickly, which I'm okay with because I do. And then as it was unfolding, he kept talking. And I thought, you told us what might happen. Now let me discover it. And the camera work is unfreakishly amazing. It's so good.
Yeah.
Well, we need to counsel him. Rodney, did you watch?
I did. And like David said, I thought it was entertaining. And it was entertaining in part because it wasn't perfect. There were mistakes. Yeah.
Right.
Big ones on both sides. Mm-hmm. There were player execution mistakes. There was some coaching, questionable coaching decisions. I think that makes a better game. And when you see Tom Brady, score five straight touchdowns without breaking a sweat, it's almost like, God, this is not very exciting. but this was, it was so fun to watch.
I enjoyed it. And you could kind of rooted for both sides, which I like.
My one takeaway is Patrick Mahomes is a generational talent. We sort of knew that going in, but he sealed the deal last night, right? He's a generational talent. He's a genius. He sees the field in a way that mortals don't see it. It's amazing to watch, and he's a genius at his peak.
Right? You don't even have to love football necessarily to watch someone like that. David, does he go on the Mount Rushmore of great quarterbacks?
Well, he's really close. I mean, if he's not on there, he's really close. He's got three now. And when you get three, you kind of go to another level. Not many guys have three Super Bowls. Now, a lot of people, a lot, I shouldn't say a lot of people, coach, there are a lot of players who, there are players who won NFL championships before they became the Super Bowl. Like Bart Starr won a bunch of NFL championships. But he only won two Super Bowls, so he's kind of tends to be underrated. He should be rated much higher than he is. But yeah, in this in the Super Bowl era, I mean, Bradshaw's got four, Montana's got four, Brady's got six or seven, I think. I think it's seven. But yeah, there's not
Aikman has three.
Aikman's got three. There's not many guys that have three. And so you're on the serious short list when you win three.
Okay, that makes me think of this. This is Chatter on Football with Tori, Roddy, and David. Somebody recently, Green Bay Packer fan, was telling me that because the way the league used to be set up, that they really have won more Super Bowls or national championships than the Pittsburgh Steelers. But my pushback on that was it was a different game. It was not as hard. I would argue that Patrick Mahomes winning a Super Bowl is harder than, I love Terry Bradshaw, the old Pittsburgh Steelers, than when Terry Bradshaw played. Is that true? Because I really need to lean in on this, David, and
I mean, it's
whack this person back.
everybody's opinion is valid on this. I don't have any, I don't discount championships won in the older eras because yes, there were fewer teams, but that means you played more good teams, right? Like there's always good teams. And so when there were only 12 teams in the league, that means you played the best teams two or three times a year,
Okay, but hasn't the level, the skill, the expertise, the train, hasn't it, it isn't it exponentially better than it was 30
Oh,
years ago?
sure, but everybody played in the era they played in. Like there's nothing that the Packers of the 60s can do about
You're not
playing
giving me the
now.
top
They didn't play
results.
now. They played in the 60s. Like they played against other players who were in that type of condition. So you can only play in the era you played in.
And the expression harder then or harder now, the one thing the guys from the 50s and 60s had, there were no domed stadiums. So if you're the Packers, well more about half of your games every season were played in deep, deep, cold, rigid. There were no significant, no serious physiology
Yeah,
knowledge.
true, true. They didn't
Guys
have the
got fingers amputated after. I mean, it was in that regard, I think that it was a different and much harder game, right?
Okay. All
Violence.
right.
It's more violence.
I'll concede to both of you. I of course watched lots of the commercials, even though I had seen many of them before. But did anybody see the local? We're in the DMV, people. For the millions of you listening around the world, we're in the Washington, D.C. area, and you'd see some of the spectacular spots. Can never beat Budweiser. And then you saw some of the local ones. Joe Jacoby's ad for the fake fireplace. Did you see that, David?
Yeah,
Did you see the whole thing?
the ending was a little odd.
Roddy, did you see this?
Oh God, yes, it was horrific. It was so bad. It reminded me of the Wayne's World. It was like the commercial you would see during the commercial break of Wayne's World.
But it was worse. It was definitely Saturday Night Live skit. So just for those of you who can't watch on News Channel 8, Joe Jacoby, epic, iconic, then Washington Redskins football player, beloved in the community, is now selling gas fireplaces. God bless him. And he's talking about all these different reasons you should buy gas fireplaces. And then some guy comes on the screen with what looks like a bloody hand
Right.
because he's chopped his fingers off. I can't believe they did this.
Popping wood.
Off chopping wood, prompting Joe Jacoby to come back on screen and say, buy a gas
With an
fireplace.
axe in his hand. With the axe in his hand. What is this?
It
Wayne's World. Wayne's World. That's just
was so great.
bizarre.
It was Monty Python is what it was.
Yeah.
Right? It was
Right.
Monty Python.
Oh
Okay.
my God. That was
All right.
something.
Holy cow.
Okay, that might have been the highlight of the evening for me, actually. I wonder what you pay for a 30. That was a minute. That wasn't a 30-second spot. I think that was a minute.
Was a
The
minute.
30, a national
Super
30-second
Bowl? I
spot
mean,
is now
that's six
$7 million.
figures minimum. Even for a local ad, that's got to be six figures.
Well, God bless him. I hope he sold some fireplaces.
I hope
Okay.
so. Oh, I hope so.
Okay, should we pretend to talk about books for a minute before?
Sure.
Okay. So
Sure.
this guy definitely should be on the Mount Rushmore of publishers. And this guy, Mark Jaffe, I saw his obit in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago. Mark Jaffe, And these are just a few of the books that he was the one who published: Jaws, The Exorcist, Catcher in the Rye, died at 102. Everybody across the industry talks about him as one of the greats, one of the last of the Mohicans, and kind of really pitched everything as no, this should be a paperback book. So Jaws was about this is what people want to take with them to the beach when they're reading those kinds of things. And it made me wonder, and I've tried a couple times and failed to get a publisher on this show. They do not like to talk. If we think writers, authors are introverts, probably don't like to talk, and they feel very comfortable helping someone else, curating somebody else's work, those kind of things, like this guy, Mark Jaffe, but they don't want to come on the show. And I'm not sure if it's, I don't think it's just me. They just don't like talking about themselves. They like talking about their work. But I think that's the end of an era. And I did talk to somebody recently retired from the publishing houses about him. She goes, "Oh, just the best." And if you were an author and he reached out to you, which he did, you'd go, "That's it. You know, I'm going to be a success because it really mattered." And she said, "But it doesn't matter anymore." And I go, "What do you mean?" She goes, "Because we were talking earlier, Dave, before you joined us, about when celebrities get into a space and they take over with their marketing machines and their PR machines and everything else, and they just muscle out everything else." She goes, "It's becoming like that with books. You've got to come to the table and be able to say, it's not just going to be the book, it's going to be the podcast, it's going to be the merch, it's going to be everything I build around this."
Netflix series, yeah.
Right, the Netflix series and everything else. So it's too bad that Mark Jaffe is gone, but we wish him the best up there over the Rainbow Bridge.
And Tor, you forgot though, there's a moral to the Jaffe story.
Which is?
You know what? How he made his fortune, Louis L'Amour. You know, which apparently sold the series, sold multiples of the all the other books he ever published, and there's a more, a lesson there. Sell to the masses first.
Absolutely. Yeah, sure.
Sell books that people want to read. I get that. Of course.
And wasn't that one of the first televised, big televised series when they did those? Yeah.
Well,
But I'm.
they did five. They did, if I'm not mistaken, it was also serials from the he they were they started as cheap movies, I think, 2 hour movies. I'm
Right.
not sure they did television. I
Oh,
don't
was
know.
it?
That's a good question,
So
though.
those were
Good question.
odors in the 40s and 50s, maybe.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, that's
Yeah.
good for the Google machine.
I remember reading, I mean, I read the story you sent, Tori. I remember reading that edition of Catcher in the Rye in high school, the one with
Really?
the red cover and no picture or anything. I remember reading that. Like that was, yeah.
Incredibly creative guy. Incredibly creative guy. But now you think about, and the other thing this person said, which is kind of depressing, she goes, "Now the pitches for a book have got to come in. It's all generated by AI. This is how the book will be structured. This is what it was like. This is how we will market it to X, Y, or Z, and we can tailor and adapt it." And so it becomes
Right.
very, machine generated almost. But then you think about, so think about those Louis L'Amour books and how many of them sold. Somebody had to go to a store. Somebody had to get in their car or get on their feet and walk to a store and go in and pick something up and pay for it. That really speaks to how successful they were. Because
Yeah.
now, it's pretty easy. You can push a couple buttons, and I'm now using my fingerprint and my handprint for everything.
Yeah.
As I am devolving to a place where I don't have to talk to anybody.
I know, it's kind of sad.
It is kind of sad.
Not here.
Not on Chatter. You got to be in person. Okay. We'll do this also kind of quickly. This is a pop-up. I didn't tell you guys about this. 130-year-old California bookstore seeks buyer. And this was also in the New York Times. Robin Pogrebin, I don't know if I'm pronouncing her name right, from Pasadena. Vroman's Bookstore, founded in 1894, has
Wow.
been a mainstay, a meeting place, a reliable sanctuary in a world of rapid change. Founder died in 1916. He left the bookstore to his godson, one of the employees, the current chairman and majority shareholder, Joel Sheldon III, 79. He's the third generation of family to guide the company. He's been doing it for over 45 years, and they've decided it's time to sell. And they're looking for somebody who will, kind of likes what politics and prose went through here in the Washington, D.C. area, looking for somebody who will really carry it on. Okay, but think about that. Who starts a bookstore in 1894? What I wanted to find out, and I went digging further into this to see what were they really selling, those kinds of things. But the kind of authors they had events at Vroman's in California: Upton Sinclair, Ray Bradbury, Ginger Rogers, Joan
Wow.
Didion, Hillary Clinton, Justice Sonia Sotomayor. Generation people come into the store and say, "I bought books here as a kid. I brought my children in. Now I'm bringing my grandchildren in." It's pretty spectacular. And they say, the story says, it's the largest independent bookstore in Southern California, two locations in Pasadena, two boutiques at the LAX airport, and an e-commerce site. So I think those millions of listeners out there, if you've got millions of dollars,
Yeah,
you
get a
should
little
buy a home.
scratch.
Right. Okay, this is kind of related to something we were going to talk about. David, would you ever want to own a bookstore?
I wouldn't be averse to it. I wouldn't be averse to it. I mean, I'm sure there are issues that I know nothing about that pop up when you own a bookstore.
Sales, money.
But the idea of helping people who want to read, that's fantastic. I'll sign up for that
Rodney?
10 times out of 10.
I think I would rather own a bar next to a bookstore.
Well, we could combine these things.
Yeah, you could combine them together.
Bar and a bookstore. We
Yeah,
could
and
combine
so
them people
together.
buy their book and then come to my bar to read their book.
Yeah.
You would hope that like Charles Bukowski would end up in your bar, and
Right. Yeah.
it would become an integral part of the lore of the
Right.
bookstore.
Growing up, for many different reasons, largely my misspent youth, I was absolutely confident that someday I would own a bar because I just like the environment. I like the friendliness of it. I was like Cheers before there was Cheers. Absolutely confident. When I was in college, I worked at a bar, Mitch's in North Carolina. And that made me think, yep, this is what I want to do. And then the older you get, you start to think, oh my God, people will get drunk. Somebody will get hurt. The police will raid my bar. And I start thinking about all the problems, which is really kind of depressing because I like the concept of a friendly, neighborly place. I like the idea of a bookstore bar. I
Yeah,
think that could be good.
I like that.
And
What
then the
was?
events we could have once a month, we could have a good event and you could do the custom cocktail, Rodney.
See,
What was
it's
the
all
bar
in
that
me.
everybody, all the literary types went to in New York? It wasn't Toots Shores, was it? But
Wasn't
anyway,
the Algonquin?
oh, that was the famous Round Table.
That's the
Yeah, but there
round
was a
table.
bar that they all went to and drank and talked all night, and it became a very famous bar because all the writers went there, and that's. Yeah, there were a lot. There were a couple of bars down in the what, way downtown. In New York, that were famous for their literary affiliations. I'm blanking on the names of
Me
some
too.
of a couple of these, but the red, is it the Red Horse? The White Horse.
Ooh,
White
you might
Horse.
be right. Okay, alert listeners, if you all know, check in and let us know, Tori at chatteronbooks.com, where I get some really interesting emails. But David, to your point about having a bookstore in the whatever 3 or 4 years we've been doing this, one of the greatest things I see, hi Lou, one of the greatest things, like my new best friend, because I'm calling him Lou. One of the greatest things I get in the emails is people will say, it never occurred to me to read that book, but I heard you guys talking about it. Or it's made me read more, those kinds of things. And I just think in this crazy, crazy world in which we find ourselves, it's one of the greatest things people can do.
Yes, and
One of the
and
greatest
if
things.
Romans is a place where people go and hang out and nurse a cup of coffee for 2 hours while they're getting it
Right.
out of the rain, I can live with that. You know what I
And
mean?
I,
That's okay.
okay, David, you're the word person. So I keep using this word safe, which does not create the right connotation of what I'm talking about. But reading, and this is what I was like as a little kid, it was a place I could go and think about things I wanted to think about and explore areas I want to explore without being judged.
Exactly.
There's
Exactly. It's
something
like a
to it too.
library, right? That's,
Yes.
that's your sanctuary. Well,
Yeah,
it was mine when I was
exactly. Okay, we're going into a new and different sanctuary for Chatter on Books here.
a
And Luis Ferrante, before we get to talk to you, Rodney is our, say hi to Rodney and David, please. Everybody say hi to Luis.
Hello.
Lauren
Hello.
Larson, who does the important work, she gets us going on the show and then she leaves. She's like, I am out of here. But Rodney, among his many, many talents, Lewis, is that he is a fantastic mixologist. It is way beyond being a bartender. He's a fantastic mixologist. And in honor of you and your book, he has created a specialty cocktail for this evening, which I am carefully nursing. So, Rodney, can you tell us a little bit about the cocktail?
Well, to Tori, thank you. Lewis, very nice to meet you. I wish I could take credit for inventing this cocktail, but part of the challenge of Chatter on Books is connecting the cocktail to the book, is you have to go out into the wide, wide world and look and see what other great minds have done before you. And this cocktail is the Black Manhattan. And it is a variation on the traditional Manhattan, which of course has sweet vermouth or French or whatever you want to call it. This it substitutes, first of all, it's rye. It has to be rye, not bourbon or Kentucky or Tennessee whiskey. It's rye. and it substitutes Averna for vermouth. Averna, for our gentle listeners that aren't familiar with the world of Amaros, is a Sicilian Amaro, and probably the now the most closely identified with Sicily. And Amaros are a class of sort of bitter aperitifs that are sort of second nature to many Italians. And Amaro has, excuse me, Averna has become the, I think, the best selling and the most exported Amaro from Sicily. And I love it. And I drank it before, you know, I had the pleasure of reading this book. But you substitute the sweet vermouth with the Averna, and then you, in addition to Angostura, you use orange bitters. And if you can find them, Sicilian blood orange bitters will make it just a little more authentic. And it's I like it regardless of whether I made it or not. But it was said to have been invented in San Francisco at a bar called Bourbon and Branch in San Francisco. So I give full credit to the wonderful bartenders there. I don't know if that's in fact the first time these two things were ever combined, but we're happy that they were and happy tonight that they are. So that's our drink tonight, the Black Manhattan, in honor of the book and the author. So
And I can endorse it heartily. I had to practice a few times over the weekend. It's great. It's great.
I will say this was an excellent pick. My father had a Manhattan, rest his soul. My father had a Manhattan every night for probably the last 20 years of his life. And he had it with vermouth, but that was his favorite drink, and he made it strong. So if any time I visited him by the house, a sip and I was done. Yeah. So I stuck.
Lou, may we call you Lou? Can we call you Lou?
Absolutely.
Okay, Lou. How old was your when was your father born? Because this sounds very similar to my dad.
My father was born in 1934. And he also liked gin and tonics when I was younger. That's my drink, gin and tonic. And then the last 20 years of his life in Manhattan every night.
Okay, so my dad, a little bit older, but he would keep a martini glass in the freezer. He's a doctor, worked very hard, would come home and every night would have a martini that would kick the tail off a donkey.
Wow.
But only one. Only
Yeah,
one.
one. My
All he
father,
needed,
too. Only
just
one.
one. That was it. And worked great.
Right.
Yeah. That's
Okay.
great.
All right, Lou. So we're big on the backstory here at Chatter on Books. People love to hear, you know, and here's what happens. If people really like the author that we have on, and they might, you know, they may have no interest in the topic of the book, but if they like the author and they're interested in their backstory, then they go out and buy the book, which is, we want people to go buy this fabulous book of yours, Borgata. But we often ask the backstory. And I usually say, okay, where are you from? Where'd you grow up? And what did you want to be when you were five? So, Lou, what did you want to be when you were five?
I had no idea. I can't even remember that long. I probably dreamed about being, you know, typical things kids like, maybe an astronaut. You know, things that crossed my mind. I was always excited about different things when I was young. It's very unfortunate that I wasn't exposed to books and more so education, until I was in prison. I wish. I mean, my father was a good man, and my mother. They were morally upright, but they. You know, they weren't educated. They didn't come from an educated family. Education wasn't stressed. They just were hardworking people. And, you know, just basically, they pushed, you know, my mother pushed and said, please, you know, half of us don't even graduate high school in the family. At least go to finish high school and please go to college. And I didn't want to. But anyway, growing up, I hung out at the OTB with my father on Saturdays. We went to the
Bonding.
racetrack. Yeah, it was bonding, exactly. Or I would hang out with him if he played cards, sometimes in the back of a bowling alley. So I could remember always being around guys chomping on cigars from when I was little. You know, so I, you know, I mean, really, I wish that somebody held my hand and brought me to a library. I read my first book in prison, and then a whole new world opened up to me. Yeah, the only reading material I remember in my house was if my mother would walk home from work, she'd maybe pick up a pile of magazines from in front of a doctor or dentist's office, you know, that was being thrown out. You know, she couldn't even afford the subscriptions back then, and bring them home, and then she'd read through them and stuff. And that's the only reading material we ever had in my house. The only other thing actually was my mother and father went to a bazaar when I was a kid, and my mother bet $1 on a raffle and won an encyclopedia set. And I had that in my room growing up. So I did, yeah, I'd pull a book off the shelf now and then. And I used it up until like, you know, the FBI was tailing me every day, and I'd look up Federal Bureau of Investigation, J. Edgar Hoover, in my encyclopedia set, yeah, trying to figure out what the hell was going on. Yeah, who are they and what can they do exactly?
Okay. Oh my God, we're gonna have to like extend this taping 45 minutes. So we're gonna get to your first book, why and how you read your first book. But again, I'm only going from the blurb on your book, Borgata. And here's the thing: every time I say Borgata, we sell a copy of the book. So Borgata, which is one part of a trilogy. But you would list yourself with a wonderful photo. Louis Ferrante is a former mafia associate and heist expert, et cetera, served 8 years in prison. I get mafia associate. What is a heist expert?
Well, that's what I did within the mafia and within the Gambino crime family. Yeah, that was everybody has sort of like an expertise. Yeah, believe it or not. You know, there was a friend of mine who was a mob boss who used to say it takes all kinds of meats to make the sauce, you know, on Sunday. It's your brajol, hot and sweet sausage, right. Pig knuckles, pig's feet, you know, you name it, it was in the sauce. And that's the same as a mafia family. They were experts in everything. Some guys were known for loan sharking. They had big loan shark books. Other guys are known for maybe stock fraud on Wall Street. They pump and dump things. They get involved. They put the muscle on different stock brokers. They're involved in that area. And I was a guy they came to if you needed a heist done. And I also worked with all five families. There was five families in New York, five Borgatas. And everybody gave me tips. I just would always, though, I answered to the Gambino crime family. That's who I put it on record with. But if you had, I didn't care how big or small the heist was, you came to me, you laid it out. And believe it or not, a lot of tips come from legitimate guys, or at that moment, semi-legitimate, not completely. Mm-hmm. But people who work, some guys get in over their head with gambling debt. Some guy maybe has a wife who's a spendthrift and he can't keep up with her. Another guy maybe falls back behind on his mortgage. And they come to me and they say, look, I got a tip for you. And it has to do maybe with where they work, the business they're involved in. And then I would put the team together, the guys together to do it. Mm-hmm. And I had experts. I knew who to grab for what. You know, there's a guy who's a good wheel man. He drove like a NASCAR guy. And there's guys who are really like, quote unquote, ballsy, where they not afraid if somebody, if somebody's armed or other people, if they're armed guards or something, they're not afraid to confront them. So it was, in a sense, you know, looking back, a lot of the crimes were violent. I went through a deep period of regret when I was in prison, realizing that what I had done, traumatizing people, was horrible. And it's something that I spent time in my prison cell wishing the concrete ceiling would just fall on top of me and end it. I mean, the deep regret I can't even begin to explain, which at some point or another prompted me to move forward and do something with my life, because I figured if I can't go back and make good for the horrible things I had done, I could at least move forward and sort of like, you know, be a productive member of society at some point and spread things to people, you know, spread things through some. I didn't realize the conduit would be books until I started reading and eventually taught myself how to write.
Okay, so we pretend the show is about books, Lou. You know, Julia Romero helped set this up. She didn't really do enough due diligence because she told you it was about books. But something, so you go to the slammer, you're in there. What made you pick up the first book? What was the inspiration? What was the book?
I was wasting away the days like every other convict, just playing cards. Usually we would play either spades or pinochle, gin rummy. You know, you walk in and out of the television room, see what's on in the TV room. And a lot of people cause trouble just to pass the day. A little drama could help pass the day. So there's a lot of things going on that aren't productive in prison. And at some point or another, I was in the hole. I went to the hole, which is the isolation unit.
Right.
For something I did not do. Somebody had thrown an apple at a prison guard, and which is an assault. And they did not know exactly who did it, but I was amidst guys who were a lot older than me, and they figured the young kid did it. I was in my late 20s at the time, as opposed to the rest of the guys.
You went in young.
I did. I was locked up at 25, and I faced the rest of my life in prison from the accumulation of charges. Let's say, for example, there's 10 armed robberies. Each one holds a 10-year statute. Then each time a gun is used in the commission of a crime, it's an additional 5 years. So for 10 robberies, you're facing 150 years. And if you try the government, if you have the audacity to make a judge a jury and a prosecutor sit through a trial for you for 2 months or 3 months, they will give you the severest penalty for having put them out. Or you could take the plea if they offer one, which is what we did, me and my co-defendants. But at some point or another, I came out of I was in the hole, rather, at that point, and I had an enlightening moment. I was beginning to question already the morality of everything I had done. My mother and father did not raise me this way. I wasn't born into the life like a lot of my friends were. So I was sort of came to it. And I said, my mother who died in my arms would have been ashamed of this. And my father, who was still alive, was coming up on the visits and he looked like a broken man. He didn't express his grief over the situation, but you know, he was still reeling over the loss of my mother. And now he's got his son in jail facing life. And I just at some point or another started to question also to the people I was around. And I realized that as bad as I was, I never wanted to run around and kill people, which happens a lot in the mafia. Sure. It happens. And if people disappear, you just don't ask questions. You assume they did something against the Bogado, the Brugada, as we would say, and they had it coming. But when I was in prison, you don't ask questions because people, just to rewind that a moment, you don't ask questions because people will wonder, hey, why is this guy asking questions? Mm. You know, who is he reporting to the FBI? Why does he want to know? It's not your business. Somebody higher up made the decision and you just assume that it was justified. So at some point or another, while I'm in prison, I'm realizing that a lot of people around me who I knew on the street, who were charged with some of the murders, the indictments are laid bare and I'm starting to see the Machiavellian intrigues behind people's deaths. And it really, really beat me up inside because I realized that a lot of people died for greed. They didn't die for example, if you commit treason in the United States, you sell nuclear secrets, let's say, to the Russian government and you were executed. The people of the United States would, for the most part, say, okay, whether I agree with it or not, I do understand it. And that was the same with the mob. If you committed some type of treason against the Borgata, you get it. But now you're realizing it wasn't treason. It was greed. And a lot of people were dispossessed of businesses they lost and were taken away from them. Money was taken away from them. Sometimes somebody wanted somebody's wife and killed the guy or had him killed. So you just, you know, it was just a new world. It was despicable to me. So then when I was in the hole over that thing that I didn't do, I had words with a guard, a prison guard, through the food slot. He was the head of the guards and I reached through the food slot. I was aggravated. I was still a hot tempered kid and I grabbed his necktie and I gave it a yank. Yeah. And it was, it came off in my hands. You know, I said, clip on your SOB. And I threw it back at him. And he said, he said, you think we'd wear, you know, real ties with you animals in here. He says, look at yourself. You're in a cage. He said, you know, and as if the big prison wasn't enough for me, even though this particular incident, I was innocent. I had been at fault for other things in the prison and I did belong in a cage. And it sort of, that's when deep thought really started to haunt me and I'm isolated. And now I look back and I say, by the grace of God, I do have faith in a higher power. And I feel like somebody who was punishing me, some higher power that was punishing me was also possibly at some point or another, I learned would reward me once I began to change my life. So I came out of the hole. And I asked my friend who was the caretaker of John Gotti's social club in Queens. He had biblical verses tattooed all over his body. So I figured he read. I said, hey, George, I said, have you ever read books? And he says, oh, no. I said, can you send me in books? And he says, sure. What kind of books you want? Big boobs, you know, big asses. What are you looking for? And I said, no, not those kind of books. Of yeah. Yeah, I said, no, totally, son, I want to read a book. So he said, he sent me in my first batch of books was, believe it or not, I'll remember them for the rest of my life. A couple of them might be behind me on these bookshelves because I've saved a lot of the books that I wrote in. Although I would pass on a lot of the fiction, a lot of the history and biographies that I wrote in and took notes of the margins I saved. But it was Napoleon. By Vincent Cronin, Caesar's Gallic Wars, and Mein Kampf by Adolf Hitler. Yeah, so three dictators. And he said, I went to the store, I told the quote-unquote the broad, which was his language back then. Huh? I know that's not appropriate today, but he said, I told the broad all about you. And she gave me those books. I said, what'd you tell her? Because I'm calling them from prison going, how the hell did you choose these things? I was looking probably for something more, I don't know, Treasure Island. The adolescent version, I didn't know that.
Louis L'Amour with pictures. Yeah,
exactly. With a lot of pictures, a lot of illustrations.
Wow. So what did you learn from those books?
Nothing. I learned that I learned that I had a very bad vocabulary to start with. I needed to buy a dictionary, which I did with stamps, which is currency in prison. I bought a dictionary and I started to look up every single word I passed that I didn't know the meaning of. I would look up and I would read the definition. I write the definition next to it. And then I would study my vocabulary every night before I went to bed. And at some point or another, my vocabulary expanded. And then I started to learn, I started to understand more and more of the things I was reading. Like, for example, you know, I pushed myself through those books. If somebody took the time to go to the bookstore to buy them for me, I would definitely push through and read them. So, I mean, how the hell do you understand the National Socialist Movement and what that lunatic was talking about, Hitler? Yeah. You know, I mean, if I read that book, Mein Kampf, today, which I've never gone back to, but I believe even today it would be difficult to understand besides, you know, Liebenstrom and a few other things that are apparent. I mean, this guy's sort of rambling, you know, but eventually you gain more and more knowledge and you start to understand the world around these figures. So I would understand Caesar and his world and the Roman Empire more and more as I would read other historians like Livy or Tacitus, and then eventually Edward Gibbon up until Michael Grant, modern day historians who cover the Roman Empire. And another favorite of mine, Beard. What's her name? She's great. Gosh. Yeah, I haven't read her in a few years, but she was great.
Okay, so I get the history part, but you also taught yourself. Again, we need like 3 hours for this. I get the history part, the perspective. You taught yourself to write too.
I did. And how I did that was a little different. I'm in prison, and you know, there are no classes to take in prison. And it's very unfortunate. Our prison system is horrible. We do not use we have control over the inmates and we don't use that to our advantage as a society in the sense that we could give them incentives to educate themselves so that the tools are there and available for them if they do decide to change their lives instead of just sending them back on the street. And the rate of recidivism has always been high. But what I did was I figured, okay, there's no classes in here, nothing I could really do in the way of, you know, joining a writing class, but I did want to write. I had this feeling I did want to write eventually from reading. Eventually I was reading 18 hours a day. I'd begin a book in the morning and, you know, close it at night. If it was, you know, 300 page book, if it was 600 pages and it took me 2 days, I'd fall asleep with the book on my chest, wake up in the morning with it. So how I taught myself how to write was I came to the realization that the greatest writing professors were in the palm of my hands. For example, everything Leo Tolstoy knows about writing is in the pages of War and Peace and Anna Karenina. Everything Gustave Flaubert knows about writing is in the pages of Madame Bovary. Everything George Eliot knows, Middlemarch, everything Charles Dickens knows, Tale of Two Cities, they've dumped it all out for you. If you just discern, if you just analyze, if you just, you know, you do an examination of what they're, how they introduce a character, how they exit a character, how they build a plot, how the chapters build as they go, how the paragraphs are structured, how the sentences are structured. And I would take meticulous notes in the margins. And that's how I taught myself how to write, by reading these masters and mistresses of 19th century fiction for the most part. Back then, I loved all of them. Dostoevsky, the Brothers Karamazov, The Idiot. You know, everything is in these pages. I remember reading Le Rouge et Le Noir, which I didn't know. I said, I went to a friend of mine who was a corporate attorney. He got locked up. And I said, I'm reading The Red and the Black. And he goes, Le Rouge et Le Noir. What the hell is that? He goes, that's the French. And I said, really? And he says, I haven't read it in many years, but Julian Sorel, tell me about what he's up to right now. And probably the same thing, but, you know, and then we engaged in conversation. That's when I was, by the way, I met him, and he was a beautiful person, when I was dropped down from a maximum security penitentiary to a medium security. And that's when I was able to encounter this guy who was a corporate attorney and very well read. I mean, you know, I never read... He used to read the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal. I never even saw these papers before in my life. If I did, they were just, you know, used to like hold up an air conditioner in the summer. You know, like you wedge it under the air conditioner. When you put the air conditioner in the window, there's a big paper. Totally. Grab that out of the neighbor's trash and put it under there. You know, that's like all I knew. So, you know, and then he's reading these newspapers and he's enlightening me to all of these different, he'd listen to opera once a week. You know, I mean, this was like incredible. And he's telling me the stories behind opera, which I never knew. It was just, oh, Dave, all here. And I'm going, what the hell? There's stories behind all that? You know, oh, they're great stories. And I started to read the stories. You know, you read Figaro, you read Wagner's operas. And so I would then get in, you know, dive into that and then take myself somewhere else after that. But eventually that's how I taught myself how to write. Now, the first book I wrote in prison, which still is yet to be published, I hope to publish it one day, I lived in the midst of a race war. And my very first day in Lewisburg Penitentiary, the Aryan Brotherhood hacked to death two black Muslim inmates. And it was a horrible race war with exchanges back and forth. I think it claimed like six or so deaths. But that was my very first day in the population. And I felt like I grew up in a neighborhood where it was a melting pot. So we had Italians, Germans, Irish, black, Spanish, Latino, Hispanic, whatever name you might want to call, but it was everybody, Asian. So we were all together. And although we used derogatory names to refer to each other, there was no deep hatred between each other. We all hung out with each other. We did business with each other. We intermingled on every type of level. And so now I'm in prison where the racial lines are so strong. And I felt like this was not something, and then I read for the first, not something that I was raised with around. It wasn't like the way I was raised in my house. You know, you just weren't even allowed to refer to people in a derogatory way in my home. Although we did that on the streets, obviously, what was John Gotti going to say? You know, go collect the money from the Asian Americans and then go see the African Americans when you're done. And then, you know, he would use the derogatory names. So that's the sort of the street that got in me. And then I'm in prison and I'm going, this is real. These racial divides are real. And I did not like it. And then I'm reading Carl Sandburg's Lincoln one day. And for the first time in my life, I read that a woman was sold on an auction block. And I remember the hair standing up on my arms. I could not believe that a human being was sold at an auction, like a car auction. I had been to car auctions. I was in the car business. I used to run chop shops. I know what a car auction is. Now you're going to take a woman and use her like she's a Cadillac or a Lincoln Continental, and people are going to sit there and bid on her. So I remember being stunned by that. And now, although I may have been taught that in school at some point or another, obviously we're taught about the institution of slavery in the early years in school, in child school, I didn't remember it, or it didn't have an impact on me. And I cheated my way through high school. So I really didn't, the impact was to me, it knocked me off my feet. And then here I am in the middle of a race war. So I wrote a book about the antebellum South, about a white family who lives on a plantation, and the African-American slaves. And unfortunately, it hasn't been published yet. There is a certain, when I came home, my agent said, look, write what you know about. You know, that's the writing world.
That's what they say.
Yeah. So, I mean, I said, hey, look, you know, I've never been a slave. I wouldn't say I've been, but I wore chains. I kind of know what it is to be in bondage. You know, I asked for it, unlike slaves. Slaves were born into it or taken and captured. I would never know what that's like. I asked for my situation, and a thousand times over, I asked for it until, you know, finally the federal government came and said, you've been begging for it. You know, now it's time to wear the chains that you've been begging for. So, you know, obviously I can't understand it, but I know what it's like to be in the center of that horrible racial hatred.
Yeah.
And that I hope to publish it one day. Maybe I will. Maybe one day someone will be interested.
And you'll have to come back and talk about it, because I just guarantee you. Now, before we talk about Brigada, the first in this trilogy, David first, then Rodney, let's talk about Lou and his life and how he got to these incredibly successful books. Questions, comments? Amazing. Yeah, well, I'm in awe. Well,
I do want to talk about the book because it's fantastic.
Fantastic.
A great book. And I thank you for educating me, because I had no idea. I thought, you know, you think about Italy, you think about, well, the Roman Empire. Well, it's been a country for centuries, for thousands of years. And you realize, no, it's Afghanistan, basically. I had no idea. I didn't know. Like, thanks.
Exactly.
So thank you for educating me on that. Like, I didn't, exactly. I didn't realize that there were so many different factions in what people now call Italy. Like that was really great.
The history section of this book is great.
Yeah, it's great. I'm a history major, so I love that stuff. I love learning about different places. So, but you obviously center on Sicily, and I am just floored by the notion of that structure, that family-based structure, surviving so many different iterations of government. And I just wonder, like, why do you think it survived? What was the
Great
special
question.
sauce that allowed that to not only survive, but to be able to ward off, massive invasions and incursions over centuries, different people, Arabs and French and English, and just over and over again, they were able to survive. And that's just amazing to me.
Great question.
Yeah, it is a great question. And I'm so glad you appreciated the book. Thank you so much for that from a historian. Thank you. You being the historian. So I guess I am now too.
Oh, you are too. Absolutely.
Yeah, thank you. Let me start by saying, in my own life, when I was growing up, we had a very close-knit Italian family. My father had seven brothers and sisters and lots of cousins, dozens of us. And we spent all of the holidays together, very close family. And we were always together. And family meant so much to us. And I feel now older, as I'm older, and it's just a generation later, we've lost it a lot. My cousins are in different states and we all talk to each other once in a while on the phone and we don't have that close glue.
Yeah.
And so what's changed? I think there are a number of things that have changed. And I think that if you live in a free society and you're able to travel to different places and you're able to chase opportunities and move along with those opportunities and follow them, and family becomes less grounded in this one sort of locale, one place. And it becomes less and less, I guess, unfortunately, less and less important. I remember my mother, my mother said that when you married into Italian families, my mother, the mother of the husband would usually teach the wife how to make the sauce that he was used to. And what's a sauce, right? Well, now a sauce is a ragu from the local supermarket. So things have changed. But throughout those centuries, when all of these invaders came and went, I think the Sicilian family unit, I found to be the case, the Sicilian family unit was the constant. It never changed. And I think that they wanted it that way, the Sicilian people. And as long as nobody interfered with that, it was very, very patriarchal, the society. And I also traced it to a lot of Arab roots, as you see in the book, which was interesting to me. Yeah, this strong Arab influence in Sicily. And, these patriarchal Arab societies are almost identical to the Sicilian patriarchy. You've seen a lot of that. And then also, too, once a man had power through his clan, through his family, and then had an extended blood family, they typically intermarried. So two or three families would begin to intermarry, and then there would be power within that sort of like multi-family unit, and they would feel like they had some sort of say in the area. So there was always this strong family structure, which was eroding even then in European society. As a lover of history, at that point in time, the French were completely different. The French had a different outlook, especially the higher class French, with regards to husbands and wives' attitudes towards each other and what they allowed themselves to do, which was even different from English society and different from American society at some point or another. But the Sicilians were very, very strong family ties. That was everything to them. And rulers, I think, who got the most out of Sicily, don't forget, they only wanted the agriculture. They wanted the natural resources out of Sicily. They never wanted the Sicilian bodies in mind. They weren't interested in the people. So the people felt like, as long as we're left alone, we won't push back. Leave us alone. And that was sort of like the Italian-American, the Italian experience, rather, after unification, when Italy became sort of the latest overlord of the Sicilian people. The Sicilians were like, well, wait a second. Why are we listening to a government in Rome, based in Rome, originally in Turin, that's going to tell us what to do? They don't understand what's going on here in the local villages, and they don't understand my daughter and my son and my uncle and my brother and my. They should have no part. And then they started to conscript the new Italian government after the Italian unification started to conscript Sicilians. And they're like, we're not going to fight for diplomacy gone awry on the continent. That has nothing to do with us. Right. Leave us alone. And they basically would sometimes, to avoid conscription, they take to the hills and become bandits and send money home. And the family were completely in sync with that. I'm going to tell you a story that's interesting. When I was growing up, my mother's mother was from Sicily. And my mother was obviously, Sicilian American, and her father was from Naples, but Italian American, my mother was. So I came home. There was a a high school down the block from my house. And there was a big fence around there, sort of like little agricultural yard where students would grow things. And I remember I was coming home with my friends when I was a kid. And we jumped the fence and we got a bunch, like we took our t-shirts off. It was in summer or whatever it was. And we filled up with our t-shirts, zucchinis and eggplants, and we brought them home. And, and I walked in the house and I threw them on the kitchen table. And my mother said, "What's this?" And I said, "Oh, we got them from the farm down the block, Ma." She goes, "What farm? With the locked gate?" And I said, "Whoa, Ma, get them out of the house now." And my grandmother's going, my grandmother's saying, "Joanne, what's the problem? My grandmother's already slicing a zucchini. She's from Sicily." My grandmother's going, "Nothing wrong with it. Nothing wrong with it. She's frying up the pan. Absolutely nothing going, Joanne, you're overreacting." And she's got the thing, and she's got the first zucchini in a pan of oil, olive oil. So, my mother's having a heart attack because my mother was raised at, in American society where this isn't right. So it's a difference in culture.
Wait, Rodney has a personal connection with the culture, Lou. Rodney, would you like to share? Lou, Rodney is from Arab, Alabama. Just need to set him up for that.
Arab, Alabama.
Go ahead, Rodney.
I'm on strict orders of omerta about any of my extended connections to Italy and Italians. But I have spent a lot of time, probably too much time, in New Orleans in my life. And I love the part of your book about New Orleans. It is a part of American history which is completely unknown to most Americans, right? That New Orleans was the Italian and Sicilian specifically influenced New Orleans was enormous. And of course, your chapter takes us to what looks to be maybe the end of Sicilian influenced New Orleans, but in fact, that was not the case at all, right? It persisted, and in many ways became even stronger as a part of the underpinning of New Orleans society. And I just wanted to say that I love that part of the book. And so let's fast forward 60 years. And we all know, and Tori is I don't even think I can say amateur aficionado of the Kennedy assassination.
Super amateur.
Yeah. But, we're all familiar with the connections, the theories, the conspiracy theories or not, about the mob and in New Orleans and the assassination of John F. Kennedy, whatever. Take us to today. What is left of the Sicilian influence in New Orleans specifically and other urban areas outside of New York? We're all familiar with the Sopranos, the Godfather, all that, but the mafia existed all over the United States, right? And you, in your book, say, "I'm going to limit this conversation to just a couple of places." But in New Orleans, it persisted and did not go away. Tell us a little bit about how, after the episode in your book, how the Sicilian influence, the mafia influence in New Orleans continued up through the rest of the 20th century.
So it was a surprise to me, being from New York, where the five New York families dominate the National Commission of Organized Crime, which is sort of like the ruling body, the round table. So yeah. You have the New York families have five seats on this commission, whereas you'd have a seat from New Orleans, another seat from Detroit, another seat from Chicago. But the New York mobsters, and New York would be considered sort of like the Rome of the Roman Empire, right, where these other places, these other metropolitan areas where Borgatas all existed, were sort of like satellites. But it was news to me to learn that really the first mafia family that appears in the United States was in New Orleans as opposed to New York, which is what I always thought it was. So the more I studied it, the more I researched it, the more I read, I realized that there were a few factors involved in that. One was when the Sicilians left Italy after the institution of slavery was abolished in the United States, which was around the same time as the unification of Italy, United States was in desperate need of cheap labor. They didn't know what to do, without the African Americans. Now, what do we do, especially down in the South? How do we keep things going? Well, we'll invite the Southern Italian immigrant wave was sort of like welcomed with open arms, and they had it bad in Italy to begin with. So the Italian government felt like the more poor people leave, the better. So get on a ship and go. And a lot of times the Italian government cleared people who were criminals for passage. saying, okay, they've been reformed, et cetera, and let's get them out of here because, you know, less mouth to feed, less mouth. So they ended up sort of in New Orleans because one is the climate. A lot of Sicilian America, I still feel like I have Mediterranean blood in my veins. And a lot of the Sicilians who came here first, they weren't up for 9 feet of snowy, you know, snows in New York for the winter. You know, really wasn't something, you know, after you leave the Mediterranean, right? So let's go to New Orleans, where the climate is pretty much close to what we knew and what we understand. And they're in desperate need of now labor. So they end up in New Orleans. And what happens is, what I found to be the case is, when they go there, wherever the big hardworking, most of the 99.9% of the immigrant wave, as all immigrant waves have been to this country, are law-abiding, legitimate people who just want an opportunity. They just want to work hard and give their families something better. So that was the case with most of the Italian Americans who just wanted an opportunity. But what would happen is they would get to a place like New Orleans and they would dominate because they had such a great work ethic. They would dominate the waterfront. They would dominate the French market, which was the fruit and vegetable market, until it was like a Sicilian market. And they would dominate all these industries across the United States, but specifically in New Orleans, let's say the waterfront, then the mobsters who always rode in on the waves, they always rode in and they gravitated towards where Sicilians migrated en masse. They end up there and they need only organize the workforce, whether into a union or whether use them and control the waterfront. So the mafia now, let's say, moves in to where the Italians are all working the waterfront. And now they could easily say, well, you know, fruit and vegetables are perishable. If they sit on the dock a couple of hours, we could destroy the industry. We'll knock it right off track. We'll grind it to a halt in just a day. So now we could get what we want by threatening a work stoppage. So the mobsters always moved in, always the Machiavellian types, the mafiosos moved in. And they did that in New Orleans, and they had a really good go at it. And they were doing phenomenal until the mass lynching in New Orleans, which I talk about, where the Italians they were in a prison. They were acquitted at trial. It seems to be a fair trial. Now, the Italians got along extremely well in New Orleans with the African Americans, and there weren't any Italian Americans or African Americans on the jury. So it's safe to say that when the jury acquitted them, it was fair. You know, they didn't have anybody on the jury that was looking out for them as far as the eye could see. Did they try to bribe the jury? A couple of instances came up where they attempted it, but they were caught. So it seems like it was a fair trial. Well, the judge had them kept in the local jail, and then the people, unhappy, the Italians were accused of killing the police chief, and the people, unhappy with the verdict, said, let's storm the jail and just hang them and kill them and shoot them. And that's basically what happened. So it looked like the mob would be wiped out after that, you know, but really what happened was the mafia is very adaptable, and they knew, hey, let's lay low. Let's play it quiet until, you know, the public clamor tones down a little. And then we'll start to rear our heads up again. And when it's time, they really know how to play this game, mobsters do. And they really, really like, first of all, they organized all the criminal element in New Orleans, which was to begin with very lawless. From the time we purchased it during the Louisiana Purchase, it was a lawless place. The dregs of society were drawn there because of its lawlessness. There's instances where policemen would walk the streets and leave a dead body on the street for 4 or 5 days before they even cleaned it up. They didn't care. It was like, big deal. There are dead bodies everywhere. So at some point or another, they reemerge. And that's the beginning of my volume 2 of the Borgata trilogy, which involves the Kennedy assassination. And we see how strong the mafia in New Orleans got during those 30, 40, 50 quiet years. They were building. And they built and they built and they built until it was sort of like they estimated it at $1 billion a year annual empire, the underworld empire in New Orleans and Texas, which was part of the New Orleans fiefdom. So that rears its head up again in volume 2 when the Kennedy administration goes after the mafia. As Bobby Kennedy, being the Attorney General of President John F. Kennedy, he makes it his personal crusade to destroy the mafia in the United States, and he'll stop at nothing. And even though some of the mob helped Kennedy in, and there's evidence to suggest that they not only helped him win certain wards in Chicago that were swing areas, but also too they donated to the West Virginia primary against Humphrey when Kennedy took the primary.
Yes,
yeah. And
that's what I wrote my senior thesis on. This is unbelievable.
Really? Oh, that's great, David.
I wrote my senior thesis on the West Virginia presidential primary.
Oh, that's great, David.
This is guaranteed that Lou has to come back with the next book. Lou, you have to promise.
I can't wait.
Come back with the next book. But let's get you out with, it's just fascinating. Really could go on forever. And I have pages of questions, which we won't get to. But here's my takeaway. And you just referenced something that made me think of this. Thinking about how they operate, how the mob operate, where they operate. They knew, and I don't know if this is still true, they knew how to read a room. They knew when to lay low. They knew when to, let's back away from the violence because that's not good for business, those kinds of things. They knew when there was an opportunity, whether it was prohibition or the stock market crashing or whatever. But is that a common thread in your experience with the mafia? A common thread where they just kind of know how to read the environment around them?
Yes, it is. And they're so reactive. And I was too when I was on the street. I wouldn't approach somebody and say, you know, normally something, things came to me, the tips, the things I was doing. And also too, you know, we used to have people coming to us all the time with opportunities. And that's how the mafia is. They're very reactive. So for example, you mentioned a couple of really, really big overall historical moments in United States history that the mafia was able to capitalize on. Prohibition, when it was probably, I think, Elihu Root, forgive me if I'm not pronouncing his name right, said it was the dumbest mistake in government the United States had ever done. And we've done quite a few here in our country. But this was the dumbest, they said. And they said, you know, how do you deprive people of alcohol? Well, it was the first time that this mafia, this mob, these mob families who are only known for blood and guts up until now. You know, they make the papers when a guy's found cut in half in a barrel. They make the papers when somebody's, you know, floating besides the South Street Wharf. You know, they now and then they make the papers for bad things. Well, now everybody's desperate for alcohol and the mob says, well, we're going to supply it. And all of a sudden it becomes, oh, wow, they're not such bad guys after all. You know, I'm dying for a Manhattan. You know, Rodney's mixing Manhattans and we can't drink them. You know, now suddenly Rodney has a place to send his great, you know, his great mixer. You know, so yeah, so now they become sort of like household friendly people to them. And they become, they give it the sexy look. Now they come out, now after repeal, Franklin Delano Roosevelt repeals prohibition. And now all of a sudden, now the stock market crashes. Nobody's got cash. So all the banks go under. The few remaining banks are extremely careful with who they give credit to. You know, and there are a lot of people who are desperately in need of cash. And the mob says, well, we're flush with cash. And they start to give loans out, but they start to dig their talons into every industry where they give a loan. You know, if you come to them and you say, well, I supply alcohol. Legitimately, maybe Rodney does throughout the country, or maybe David says, "Well, I have laundromats all over the place, or I'm in charge of waste removal. I need a loan because I want to buy 25 more garbage trucks." Okay, but we want to be involved in this a little, so maybe we give us a couple of shares. Maybe I could put my wife in, you know, as a work, you know, somebody in there as a shareholder, and they start to get involved in more and more industries, and they're infiltrating the unions at the same time. So they really, really spread out because of their deep pockets after Prohibition. Then World War II comes around, and the naval intelligence has, we got Nazi subs off the coast of Long Island. The USS Lafayette / USS Normandy, it was renamed the Lafayette. It was a French ocean liner that was taken from us. You know, we weren't going to give it back after war broke out, World War II. After the Nazis invaded France, we said, why give them back another ship? That sunk. And, you know, after that sunk, it was it sabotage was the question. So they said, well, the U.S. Navy intelligence says we need to secure the docks. Why don't we tap the mob who controls the waterfront? Mm-hmm. And mob signs on and says, sure, we'll be the roving eyes, the roving lighthouses along the whole eastern seaboard for the United States government. And in return, the government's really not looking too much, and the FBI isn't, and the rest of them aren't looking too very deeply at what goes in and out of the ports. Sure, we'll make sure the ammunition gets there, the tanks, the you know, the B-52 or B-29 bombers or whatever it was, B-29. We'll make sure all the parts get there. We'll make sure this gets there, that gets there, the troops get there. There's a lot of household goods that might not make it onto the ship today or might not make it off the dock today. So, you know, they really, really always capitalized. They were always reactive, responding to events as they happened.
Very, very opportunistic. Very opportunistic.
Yes.
All right. Let's wrap it up with this. Guarantee that you will come back. And it's just going to make, it's already made David's day, but it's going to make David's day when you come back and you can talk about his thesis. Be great.
Hey, Chatterheads, it's Jamie here with a couple of quick items before you go. First of all, thanks so much for listening. We really appreciate your time. There are, however, a few things you can do to help us keep Chatter chugging along. Of course, you can follow us in all the usual places, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Join us on Patreon for bonus outtakes from the show, including Tori's rapid-fire lightning round with the guest and some pre- and post-show persiflage that we usually edit out. Go to chatteronbooks.com to subscribe to our monthly newsletter, where you'll get a sneak peek at the upcoming authors. And don't forget, if you're buying books, please try bookshop.org. It's easy, it's online, and the best thing is you'll be supporting your favorite independent bookstores and affiliates like Chatter on Books. So download us wherever you get your podcasts. Give us a review on Apple if you're feeling so disposed. But, you know, most importantly, just stay in touch. Send questions, comments, ideas, and even insults to info@chatteronbooks.com. That's info@chatteronbooks.com. And thanks again for listening. Stay safe. We'll see you next time.
All right. And you're going to, we know what is next. It's the second part of the trilogy of Borgata, Rise of Empire, History of the American Mafia. Fabulous. It's life lessons. It's business lessons. It's all sorts of things. Lou, it's just really a pleasure to meet you. So glad you found good ways to use your time and energies and obvious brains. So hope everybody goes out and buys the book. Lauren, wherever you are, thanks for your help. Rodney, David, great to see you. We'll see you soon. We're back in a couple of weeks with many different authors. But you guys got to check in. And we are out.